Welcome to Spartan Speak, a production of the Lansing State Journal, Detroit Free Press, and USA Today Network. I'm Graham Couch with the Lansing State Journal, alongside my colleague Chris Solari from the Detroit Free Press. And this is Spartan Speak, the beginning of the Jonathan Smith era. And the A.J. Hogard is not the starting point guard for the moment era of Michigan State basketball. Lots to talk about today. Apologies for not doing this earlier in the week. I got drilled with an illness that may or may not have been the fault of a woman who was very inconsiderate on the plane I was on last week, hacking up a lung. And nonetheless,
could have been a basketball player's fault too.
Yes, this could have been Tyson Walker's fault last week. This is karma for me writing that last week. And I stand by my 1996
column. You asked Tom Izzo about it.
I did. I stand by my 1996 column in the Lansing Sexton High School student newspaper in which I said, anybody who comes to school sick should be suspended for 3 days, same as punching somebody in the face, because the result is just as bad. This stinks. But I'm feeling a lot better and excited to talk about MSU and MSU football first, because they have a new coach. And the last time we talked, you know, they hadn't even played Penn State yet. I don't think we need to spend any time on that.
At least in podcast form. We did a recap video where we...
That's true.
Kind of...
That's a good point.
I mean, it was about 12 out, not even 12 hours before Jonathan Smith was hired, maybe around that. And pretty much we kind of had heard it coming from, you know, early Thanksgiving week onward.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is this went about as well as Michigan State and Alan Haller could have hoped. It was relatively silent. It wasn't, I mean, he apparently knew this is who he wanted at least a couple weeks out. He knew he wanted this to play out this way, maybe more from when he had started talking to Smith. And, you know, guys like you and I started to know this was where it was headed early in Thanksgiving week. And then there was no wasted time. Both Jonathan Smith's former team and Michigan State play Friday night. By the middle of the noon games on Saturday, Michigan State is announcing the hire, not letting it trickle out, not letting national reporters hear it from some agent somewhere, nothing else. It was on their terms very quickly that Jonathan Smith was the new football coach. And from the beginning, Haller said that he wanted this to be a small circle. It wound up being, I think, even smaller than I realized, because for a long time it was mostly him. And you know, within 48 hours later, he's introduced at Michigan State. Your initial, I guess, 72 hours, it was Tuesday, but your initial impressions of the hire, Chris, and then of Jonathan Smith on Tuesday.
Yeah, I'd agree with you on the I don't want to say silence of the search, but the legitimate information was pretty thin for a long while. And, you know, that's a credit to Alan Haller. And in a lot of ways, and I kind of said this from the outset, that the Urban Meyer smokescreen, and, you know, whether you want to believe the veracity or not of it, or however you want to look at it, it was a smokescreen that allowed Alan Haller to operate his search his way. And that was one of the first things that he talked about, is thanking the board for letting him do a thorough search and make the hire. So, you know, even though the board hasn't technically officially had the meeting to approve the contract yet, that tacit rubber stamp is kind of already there and in place, prepared for Jonathan Smith to just basically go through the formalities. And the initial impressions of him, he seems genuine, which I think is an important thing for this program at the moment. He seems, I don't want to say, he has a lot to learn in terms of the area, in terms of the school, in terms of the rival. I mean, he hadn't even taken a walk on campus by day three. And it's understandable, because he's got to meet with all the players and all the coaching staff that's outbound, and meet with the administration and everybody else. So, I mean, he's been tucked away in the football building in meetings since he arrived, more or less. So, but the little that we got to talk to him off the podium, I sense that he is a guy that says some pretty substantive things, but not very verbose. He wouldn't fit well on this podcast. Let's put it that way. But that's not, we don't have any substance, and we are very verbose. Yeah. So
no, I think I got it. That was a shot at both of us. It was solid. One of the things I think stands out about him to me is that he is less comfortable selling himself than he is coaching football.
Yes.
And that's not to knock Mel Tucker, who had some swagger, and part of the business of coaching college football is selling your program as a head coach. That's not to say you can't do both, and I'm not knocking that, but that is clear that he is not somebody who he's different than Mel, and something that Alan Haller would be careful not to say, but I think knew, is that they had to hire somebody a little different than Mel. You can't repeat the same, hire the same personality and the same characteristics. And I think there's a lot in Jonathan Smith that looks like a program builder, somebody who is, everybody I've talked to, and there have been about, three people who have, former coaches or coaches who have from afar looked at the work he's done and thinks it's impressive. And people will give it to you straight, so to speak, I think he has the respect of his peers, and that is something that sort of stands out. And that's not every coach who gets hired at these big jobs have that sort of thing. So that stood out to me right away. And I think the fit is interesting because Chris, you bring up a really good point there. A lot to learn, and in a lot of ways he does, about Michigan State specifically, the history of the program, the campus. But one of the things, when you talk about fit, you talk about being at the school that, and Haller put this really interestingly. He said, it's not about necessarily knowing exactly how, Michigan versus Michigan State. It's understanding that there is a school just up or down the road that you hate, that sometimes looks down on you and you want to beat them.
Yeah.
Understanding the dynamic that I expect exists for Oregon State with Oregon, that has some similar tentacles to what Michigan State and Michigan is. But yeah, look, he has no in-state or west of Montana coaching experience or ties. They have one guy on their roster who is from Chicago. Nobody else from the Midwest. He was recruited by two coaches who are no longer on Oregon State staff. So they are going to, I think, keep a few coaches. I think he'll hire a few coaches from here, and he'll bring some of his coaches. It'll be a mix. But he's obviously well aware of that.
Yeah, you have to. I mean, especially at this point where you got signing day less than a month out for the early signing day. And he was, I thought, cautious to say, well, there is also a second signing day. And, that people kind of forget that because of the way that things have been of late, where the early signing period is the point where you have the highest end kids all inking their letter of intent and becoming committed players instead of simply pledges. So that, that there's a lot of ground to make up in that. It sounds like Anthony Carey, the four-star running back, is once again back in the mix after decommitting. And I think, the things that really need to be done at the moment for Jonathan Smith is, one, identifying the players who need re-recruited, maybe guys who decommitted or guys like Nick Marsh. Just make sure we're keeping you guys in the fold. The Lewinsky brothers, keep them in the fold and on track. Henry Hasselbeck, those kind of guys. I think they've got eight guys that are committed still, and they lost six in that process so they could go that. But he also has to try and re-recruit the roster and guys that he wants. I mean, 14 players going into the portal since Friday's game. There's really after the hiring on Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday is when on Wednesday, a lot of those guys went into the 14, all three quarterbacks, three receivers, five offensive linemen. It's a lot of bodies going in right away. And to me, I don't know about you, but the biggest one that I thought that is somewhat a surprise and someone they need to prioritize is Derek Harmon, because Derek Harmon is still a young impact defensive tackle, yeah. And those are hard to come by. But, you know, outside of all those things, you know, in terms of, you know, getting the lay of the land of guys that are part of or about to be part of your program, Jonathan Smith admitted he has to get out in the car and start driving to these high schools, something that really Mel Tucker and his staff couldn't do because of the pandemic. You know, because I do think that, you know, when you talk about the personality, you know, the first couple times that we talked to Mel Tucker, it felt, and, you know, if you can kind of put yourself back, Graham, into that February, early March 2020 time period, I mean, he felt like he had a little bit of Tom Izzo vibe to him at that point. And, you know, I don't know how much the pandemic disrupted that, it was just such a weird time. I mean, obviously everything that transpired after, you know, you started to understand what happened and the downfall of Mel Tucker. But looking back to that early 2020 period, you know, he seemed like a good hire and a good fit under the circumstances that they had. But even Alan Haller admitted they didn't have time to do their due diligence, and it really kind of bit them. This time they had nothing but time to identify and examine candidates to how they to their specifications, and I thought Alan Haller did a good job of that.
Yeah, you know, it. So there are a couple things. One, I thought it was interesting how much Jonathan Smith kept saying that, you know, who is in our locker room in January and ready to go, we'll be ready to go with. He was basically giving. Understanding that some guys might need some time, some space, they're going to have to recruit guys, they're going to have to figure some things out. I don't think he's going to hold the portal against any Michigan State player. And I think a number of these guys who are jumping in the portal will have to make a decision. But if they're back in the fold and ready to go in January and still enrolled at Michigan State, that's fine. Because some of these guys will find there's not a better situation for them out there. Some of them may just want to see what's out there. I don't think everybody is necessarily gone. It will be interesting. I my guess is none of the three quarterbacks are back.
I could see maybe one of them. I mean, you know, I do think it's, you know, because
the, who would that, yeah.
I think when we start looking at that, I mean, you know, Uyangalela from Oregon State jumped in the portal on Thursday. And he really had a renaissance under Jonathan Smith, and I think he has 1 year left. He had transferred there from Clemson, and really, if Michigan State adds him, could be an instant starter at a high level next year. If that works, and I don't know if it will. I mean, you know, people are talking about whether his freshman out there, Aiden Chiles, comes, and that's a conflict with Sam Levitt, because Chiles was recruited over Sam Levitt at Oregon State.
And Sam Levitt seems to be holding that against him.
Yeah. And the other one is Dante Moore jumping in the portal. Yeah, I mean, to me, that's a big one. And I think that's to me, if you're going to go after a younger quarterback, that's the guy that Jonathan Smith needs to go after, because you need to start making big inroads into Detroit, and that would be a massive splash right away in your biggest recruiting area in the backyard.
And well, he's also got to evaluate and think, you know, I know, you know, he's a five-star kid, but you also have to look at who are the, I mean, he obviously knows Chiles, right? I mean, well, the question is, you have to evaluate these kids and say which of them can be a really good quarterback, because, you know, Dante Moore didn't have a great year, and, you know, he'll know the two Oregon State kids, obviously, and he'll he's a quarterback's guy, and so they'll have a feel for it. But if you think you can shape Moore into a really good quarterback, the one advantage of these young guys transferring is it's a one-time transfer. So if you transfer in as a sophomore, yeah, that's like the old, you're in, you know. It's not like, you know, the grad transfers have the ability to keep moving. And
Nate Carter's a good example of that. Nate Carter is, he is a third year sophomore, going to be, have the rest of his eligibility. He can't transfer until he graduates. And from what, the way I understand it, those, even the graduate transfers have now been minimized to one time graduate transfers. So that's, you know, the hope and goal is to try and cut down on guys going to the portal, as my phone has been blowing up all the last 2-3 days with every guy around the country at every single level, of from Monmouth and Harvard all the way up to Florida State and LSU and, you know, all the power brokers. I mean, that's where we're at. I mean, I don't know how that, I mean, it, you got to have a coach that understands that. My phone's been blowing up since basically Wednesday, Thursday, all day. Seemingly like every 2 or 3 minutes of guys entering the transfer portal from every level, from Monmouth and Harvard to LSU, Florida State, you know, all the major power brokers. So, I mean, it's kind of what the day and age of college football is. And, you know, I do think it's important that they, Michigan State, was able to hire someone who has had to kind of navigate that over the course of the last few years. But I don't know what the future is moving forward. But if you aren't using it as a tool, like Jonathan Smith said, you're not going to get ahead. And so guys like Dante Moore and Ungilela and everybody else that are going in there, I mean, particularly the quarterback position, because who knows what's going to happen. But I do think that one interesting thing, if they did get Ungilela, and I may be butchering his name completely, but I think I'm in that ballpark. He and Caden Hauser both went to St. John Bosco, which is kind of an interesting little tidbit there. But you also, if you're Jonathan Smith, need to keep some separation in your quarterback class. That's something that Mark D'Antonio did. You remember, a quarterback, a class. You've got Henry Hasselbeck coming in. So how do you space those guys out and make sure that guys in that quarterback room feel like they have a legitimate opportunity to compete for the job? That's going to be a challenge if nobody sticks around.
It'll be interesting, because I still think, based on what we saw from Sam Leavitt, I would take a it doesn't sound like it, but I would take a churn at trying to convince that kid to stick around. It's going to be very interesting to see what's so crazy and just asinine about the calendar now. This is why they have to change the calendar and move signing day back to February, you've got so much that has to be done by about December 20th. I think the 20th is the 21st. The 20th, I think, is the signing day, early signing day period. Yeah. So basically between then, you have to work on securing your own roster, hit the road to visit all these recruits, work the transfer portal, and hire a staff.
Recruit.
It's not fair to not just the coaches. It's not fair to the players at the schools currently. This is a month that should be no coaches on the road. They should be preparing for bowl games. I mean, you got the new Oregon State coach, who might have been the defensive coordinator at Michigan State if he hadn't taken the job, saying he's not actually going to coach in the bowl game because he has to worry about all these other things. We're not in a good place when coaches who have previously been at the school, even if they are taking over a different role, can't coach in the bowl game because there's so much going on. It should be, you're entirely on campus, and you are trying to recruit your own roster, work the transfer portal, but not out recruiting at this point.
Well, I mean, this is what they wanted. I mean, this is kind of what coaches wanted, kind of what everybody in college sports wanted. You wanted an early signing period. Well, to me, you know, the early signing period, move it before the season. I mean, college basketball's early signing period is before the high school basketball season begins. Why shouldn't the high school football be like that? I mean, guys talked so often about, I want to get this out of the way and focus on my season. Well, put pen to paper if you want to get it out of the way, because all that happens between the end of most kids' high school season, you know, in late October, you know, early to mid-November. Some high schools go deep into November. The only thing that happens is guys end up decommitting and finding somewhere else to go. So this, to me, minimizes that flipping, you know, that flipping season that these recruitniks have created for these kids. So, I mean, if you're going to do it, move it up to before the season starts, and you probably won't get as many kids signing, which still brings back the impact in February and allows
the kids who sign in August
to happen.
Would have the ability to get out of any letter of intent if the head coach left. That would be still the rule, and that would, you know, create some stability. Now, there might be assistants who left, and that would, you know, ruffle some feathers, but it would certainly allow some kids to
But that happens in basketball, right, too, so what's the difference, you know?
Right.
I mean, assistants leaving basketball. It's not, you get a little bit frustrated and tired seeing football treated like the golden calf when the rules aren't nearly as equitable as for other sports. And it works in other sports. This is the only one where you see some guys flipping basketball, a handful, maybe. You don't see that what they've created. It's a cottage industry the whole recruiting aspect of it where, and literally the guys that run the recruiting sites will tell you this is going to happen. They'll tell you, well, he's going to commit, but he's still keeping his options open, or he's going to keep his options open, or he's about to flip. These guys are going to flip. And so what is it? It's the pledge and commitment argument. So move it to August, you'll have guys that actually commit.
I do sort of half jokingly wait for the day that, former college football player in his late 20s brings his old football coach into divorce court when he is a witness to say, look, I was taught a commitment was something that was just something you said, and then you changed your mind, and then I didn't realize this had any bearing on people's lives, and it was then I was supposed to commit and then explore. In college I then took four other visits, and so why can't that work with my personal life?
And he will be presenting it to the judge in notes form, along with the notes on his phone, and then also a very doctored up photo shot to say,
please,
I'm entering divorce court.
Let's get back to Jonathan Smith and how everything went down, and going back to whether this was a good hire for Michigan State. I think obviously right now it's hard to see how it's not. It seems like this is a guy, when you look at the possible people out there, and I'm not, you know, Urban Meyer, who knows what that would have been. I don't think Alan Haller ever had designs on Urban Meyer. I'm not saying that there weren't, the Matt Ishbia thing was real, but Matt Ishbia is not the athletic director. It's not just because Matt Ishbia would have loved Urban Meyer, that doesn't mean that's going to happen. But in terms of where Haller's focus was and what Haller was looking for, a sitting head coach, and he originally had 12 candidates by himself, narrowed it to five, brought a few other people in, including trusted confidant Jen Smith, who he says sort of covers his blind spot, is her strength. She's the one who went out to Oregon with him, and then they were going to interview three candidates in person, interviewed Jonathan Smith first. I believe Haller wouldn't say this, but I believe interviewed Mike Elko.
And I'd heard through sources that Elko withdrew his name the day before Thanksgiving because he believed that Smith was going to be the head coach.
And then there was a third candidate. I don't know who that was that they were going to, but the interview in person was going to be a couple days out. And Haller was just thinking, what am I doing? Smith is the guy. He didn't know if the UCLA job was going to open up or anything like that, where, you know, he's a guy who grew up obviously in Pasadena. And so this seems like Haller's genuine first choice. And you can see a lot of the reasons for it, for what Michigan State needs right now. Somebody who can take a program. Like, I think Michigan State's in a lot better shape than Oregon State was when he took over Oregon State. They have better resources than he had when. But they are going to be in a conference with a lot of behemoths. And now you don't have to win that league anymore. You just got to get to about 10 games, 10 wins to get in the playoff. But and they're not always going to have to play Ohio State every year. That's going to be kind of an every other year thing. It's still going to be a difficult road. And I think what Alan Haller saw was, if you can get somebody who can build a solid program that is winning 8-9 games a year, from there you can grow. But you're not just going to shoot rocket to the top of this thing and all of a sudden become something you weren't. I think one of the problems with Mel Tucker that was, and obviously there wound up being a few, but one of the in terms of fit was where he came from, the other schools,
yep.
Georgia, Alabama, Ohio State, and wanting to create Michigan State in a mold of them, and that's not who MSU is. And I know some people want it to be, but it just never – it. As long as you care this deeply about A.J. Hogarth at point guard, your football program could never be Ohio State or Alabama or Georgia, because they don't care who's playing point guard for them. And that matters in priorities and finances and all sorts of things. I think that was one of the things. But Jonathan Smith comes from a place that is – an idea of how to build a program, what it looks like, that's a better fit for who MSU is.
I mean, listen, Mel Tucker, a guy from Cleveland, Ohio, completely abandoned recruiting Ohio. That is, it's mind-numbing. It speaks more to me about kind of what you said, where he came from. I mean, he came from Ohio State. He came through Alabama. He came through Georgia. All those programs were at an elite level and have been for decades. And Mel Tucker kind of thought that you could just plunge in head first. It's kind of Pollyanna-ish to think that, because all you had to do was look at the previous staff and see when they were recruiting at a high level, they were doing it with guys from Ohio, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, and a couple guys from Georgia, a couple guys from Florida, a couple guys here or there. This is the problem in the transfer portal era. If you were recruiting outside of your region, you're just as likely for those guys to jump ship now, as we've seen. And it's not tenable.
And this is the one thing I thought Barnett brought up at his final presser, which I thought was one of his better pressers other than the idea that he was going to be the head coach. But he brought up that.
Yeah, I think there was always a wink and a nod with that. Yeah. Like,
But he did bring up how you built it, how Michigan State has been successful, the places you go, into Florida, into Georgia a little bit. But the core of who you get is the Midwest and this region and Western PA and Ohio and Illinois and Indiana and Michigan. And, you know, it the other dynamic that will get really interesting, and I have not done a lot of reporting on this yet, but there is this sort of elephant in the room, or as Tom Izzo would say, white elephant in the room. And as somebody who's watched a lot of Hallmark Christmas movies, I do want Tom Izzo to watch some Hallmark Christmas movies just so he can see some white elephant parties and what's going on? The white elephant party. Anyway, but
I should recommend but I was going to say, if you're going to do that for Izzo, recommend to him to watch how many liver pills Carter has.
Oh, that saying
comes to Christmas.
No, I was just going to give him a list of Hallmark movies, including one I watched this evening. But the elephant in the room is the NIL situation and what Michigan State has there. What SD4L is, the shell that it was, what it's still doing as an operational arm, it's still something you see out there. It is not. I continue to think that it has to be rebranded, and the timing of when they shut that down and stop paying some of those contracts, you don't repair those relationships. And I don't think, and I understand people should be able to do what they want with their money. I'm not saying, and I understand there might have been some frustrations on Steve's.
Then don't sign contracts, the guys.
That's the thing. The contracts are going to have to be different next time. You know, I understand you think a lot of guys are going to leave, but there are guys who might not have left who are probably going to leave now because they don't trust that that's going to be there, or they're more apt to go somewhere else with an NIL deal. I just think that, so where that is, again, it's not
you got to know that's going to be used in recruiting.
Oh, 100%.
I mean, plain and simple, they're going to be negatively recruited and are being negatively recruited against with that.
And so SD4L, which is still funding the basketball team at very high levels, and still is a meaningful saying to a lot of alums of a different era and people who once held that and sold that brand over to the group that has it now. I think that in some ways you just ought to give it back and then do a separate deal. But I am curious where promises are being made financially there now, what they're able to do. And obviously you're going to have a collective, you know, of sorts. You're going to have a, but you also, one of the things that I don't know where they are with this is, you know, it's okay if you're not a school that recruits with NIL. You just have to decide, again, this goes back to deciding what you are before who you hire. And these conversations were probably had with Jonathan Smith. He probably has a pretty good sense of it. And so that's one thing that I think needs to sort of be understood and answered in terms of what they're working with and what's now an important part of it. Because obviously his salary is more than Mel Tucker was making just from the school, right? That's a $7.25 million. Mel Tucker was about $7.1 million.
Well, it's $6.6 million in base salary, and then
TV
the
money.
Escalators. The one plus is outside. Some of it could be outside money.
Okay. So
we haven't seen the official contract. All we've seen is the term sheet.
Term sheet. Okay, that's fair enough. The contract's good though. The assistant salary pool is going to be fine there. Obviously, there's a lot of money to do the old school ways of building a program. The question is the new school stuff. What is there for MSU? And I think that's going to matter here eventually in keeping this roster and recruiting kids in.
Oh, it absolutely matters.
Transfer portal. Yeah.
Absolutely matters. I mean,
and so what is there?
You're not getting guys. I mean, coaches have been talking about $1 million, the Washington State quarterback has apparently $7 or $8 million plus offers for next year and NIL money, I use air quotes. I mean, this is what it is.
Well, and so, but so the question is, are you recruiting with it? I think you can be a school where kids show up, and it's like once you get there, there is money for you.
I don't think that's
and recruiting.
Then you're a mid tier to lower tier program at that point.
I think Michigan does a lot of that. I think there's ways to do it. I mean, you just have to know when you get there, it's there.
We also don't know if Michigan's publicizing some of the things that they're doing.
True. That's very true. Yeah, and so anyway, that is a big question I have that I have not had answered or worked on to a great degree yet, and will, because that will, I think, tell us what Michigan State's ceiling can be in a lot of ways, and some of that's going to be, you know, yes, on some fans to contribute, but that's also going to be on the university to explain how that works, to create a system where people get like Spartan Fund points for NIL giving, because that's what people want.
But you're not giving to the university. That's the problem. That's where the fallacy is. And, you know, there's not a lot, I don't want to say information, because, I mean, we've reported it, many people have reported it, but I don't think there's a lot of common understanding and knowledge that this money isn't coming from the school. And these things aren't being run by the school and not allowed to be run by the school, even though, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, every coach, there's coaches who have to know, I need this much money for this player. And, you know, it's the sham of what it is right now. It is what it is. It's not saying it's good. And at some point, there's going to be another shoe to drop with all the NIL mess.
Well, it's not just the NIL thing might be secondary to a complete change down the road in short order here, as the power leagues step away, as they become employees or somehow compensated. Yes. That's a huge thing in the next few years.
Wait for the unionization and the benefits and everything else to come with it.
But a lot of they don't want that. The players don't want to be employees, because there's a lot of downsides for that too for them. So it's going to be interesting how that all gets handled. But the problem is, in the near term, and even in the long term, NIL is going to be a part of things, and you need to have an operation in place that supports kids at a level that allows you to be competitive at the level you're willing to compete at. So the one thing I do like about sort of NIL and collectives is if you operationally do it right, if you get some big boosters running something and then say, this is how you donate to fans, this is how you support it, and then you're not getting kids because you don't have the money. It's back on everybody in the program. It's back on the fan base. Everybody's expectations have to be tailored to what they're willing to contribute in some ways, even if that's, I think that is going to be one of the really interesting things moving forward. But for MSU, we have to find out what they have, how much they're able to compete. You know, from what I understand, they didn't lose Keon Coleman to Florida State for NIL. My understanding is he took a pay cut to go to Florida State. They have not lost kids to NIL yet. NIL has not bit this program a ton yet until they took NIL away from them in the middle of the season, and we'll see what the ripple effect of that is. Some of the kids who transfer, it'll be interesting to talk to them how much that played into it, and because I do think that destabilized the roster more than it needed to be.
And let's understand something else here. If we're going to call this what it is, and it's business, this isn't hurt feelings. These aren't kids that are having hurt feelings because something was done. This was a business transaction that was pulled out from and under them. And if you aren't going to operate like a business, then why should they? Why should the kids do that? Why should the kids give you the benefit of the doubt as an NIL collective if you aren't operating like a business? This isn't charity anymore, period. The high-end boosters wouldn't have done this at their own companies, and they wouldn't have been allowed to, and you cannot do this to these college athletes at this point for guys that you have a signed contract with and that are now relying on that money, and then you just pull it out from around them. It's a bad, 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 bad look.
The contracts will have to be written differently, and there was a loophole that allowed them to do it, and the next ones won't have that ability. I promise you that, because like for the This Is Sparta collective, they didn't pull out their contracts are more firm, and those athletes in other sports are all still fine and happy with their arrangement. I guess so. The next thing on football before we talk hoops, is there anything else we need? I mean, the football game itself was the most non-competitive thing. We don't need to get into that. Anything else? The coaching staff will be interesting to watch in the coming days. Maybe when we talk next week, we'll have some answers there on more specifics.
If we're looking at guys that might be carried over, you know, if you want to talk about anything about the Penn State game, I'm trying to have a hard time.
Yeah,
I've had a hard time over the last few days rectifying whether or not that coaching staff gave up on the kids during that game on the offensive side, because it was run, run, pass, punt. It was predictable. They weren't getting anything done, and it was getting worse and worse and worse, and there wasn't much outside of that ill-advised pass, end-around pass that went south and turned into a sack and an intentional grounding. But I also understand that Penn State was physically superior in that game, and teeing up on Caden Hauser and really getting around their pass rush was getting around that offensive line all day, and they had, I think, 7 sacks, but Hauser got hit a lot. And so I have a hard time rectifying whether or not the coaching staff gave up on the kids or whether they were trying to protect them from getting hurt. That's a hard line, and that really kind of summed up the end of that season and that era.
Yeah, but my biggest guess for guys to stick around from that staff would be Barnett, who I had a weird interaction with, and, you know, bless Harlan for being honest, but I think he felt like he overstepped. I shot him a text and just said, you know, are you sticking around, being retained? And he said, yes. I said, you know your role yet? And he said, not yet. So I updated the story, tweeted it out. And then like an hour later, he was clearly hearing from people, and he was like, well, there's a possibility. I'm like, all right, okay. I still have to talk to Jonathan Smith. All right. So we'll see where that, I would guess he's coming back, based on what he's told recruits and what would make a lot of sense, I think, for Jonathan Smith in terms of trying to keep this team together. Because what did Harlan Barnett do best as an interim head coach? Kept that group together. And then Courtney Hawkins is a name that you haven't heard a receivers coach necessarily coming over with all the offensive guys. You know, Nick Marsh's recruitment is tied to him. Beyond that, I think Hawkins is a guy, Chris, that has impressed both you and I at times. Other receivers have spoke highly of. And so I just, and he's not a guy who's bounced around as an assistant a lot of places. Obviously, he came from the, you know, he's an alum who came through the high school ranks to here. It just makes a lot of sense to me.
It makes way more sense. And it, when you look at it from a recruiting standpoint, Harlan Barnett has recruited Ohio, grew up in Cincinnati, knows all the coaches there. Courtney Hawkins grew up in Michigan, played at Michigan State. Both of those guys played at Michigan State, but Hawkins, having been a high school coach, being an athletic director, knows all the important people around the state. That's the kind of institutional knowledge that Jonathan Smith needs to keep and rely on. And I think once you start getting into the games, it helps transition and translate things about the school and the rivalries to kids.
Yep. Yep.
And it also does that to Jonathan Smith. Having that institutional knowledge of those two guys, what they bring in recruiting, having Mark D'Antonio around, obviously having Alan Haller having played here, you need as much of that, boost or propping up when you are new to an area. And I think, you know, those are the guys that, to me, because the rest of Mel Tucker's staff, who had previously been around here, none of them. Kapilovich, no.
Yeah.
Jay Johnson, no. Scotty Hazleton, no. Ephraim Reed, no. I mean, all these guys that were on that staff outside of Hawkins and Barnett haven't been here. Dyron Reynolds, Jim Salgado, none of them had ties to the state, the area, or even the region.
And I think with both Hawkins and Barnett, too, you're talking about two guys, NFL pedigrees as well. I mean, you know, if coached.
It's not, yeah, you're not just like.
It's not charity
keeping
here.
Guys around.
No,
yeah.
No. These guys have coached guys who become NFL pros, and so there's that too. Anyway, that'll be for the next pod. We'll get into that more next week. Let us talk some hoops, because a lot has happened in basketball as well. Michigan State played an Arizona team that I think is they're kind of who I think is this year's UConn. When I watched them, similar to last year, I was out in Portland and watched UConn tear through that tournament and MSU's bracket. And there's the size, the depth, the number of quality playmakers.
The size, the depth of size.
And Michigan State looked completely outclassed for a while and then got it together and put up a heck of a fight in the second half. And then the AP voters, who didn't apparently watch the game, dropped them six spots, even though Ken Pom put them up six spots. But that's neither here nor there. You know.
The USA Today coaches poll, powered by Gannett, still has Michigan State at number 25, so you will see that in our...
There you go.
Our Gannett stories, that you will see that Michigan State is still number 25.
So and then they play Georgia Southern, who is, you know, the worst team they played, at least in terms of Ken Pom, this year, and didn't shoot well, and they've got some athletes and whatnot, but just a mismatch game. The biggest thing from the first game I just mentioned, Arizona to Georgia Southern, Chris, was the change in the starting lineup, and Cooper sitting for Mati Sissoko, big whoop. I think by the end Cooper will be back in that spot, but those two are playing fairly interchangeable minutes. I think Cooper provides more.
Yeah,
but it is the A.J. Hogard and Izzo putting some teeth to the idea that he might shake things up. The question is that a one-game type shakeup? Or is and because he starts Holloman, and it's not starting Jeremy Fears either, is that a move that lasts for a little while? What's your best guess?
He started Holloman and then brought Fears off the bench,
yep.
And then brought Hogard off the bench 3 minutes after that. So,
yep.
You know... There was a message being sent there. I don't know how it might go. I'm not really sure what to make of A.J. Hogard right now, quite honestly. And I think Tom Izzo doesn't know what to make of it. I mean, at that post-game press conference after the Georgia Southern game, he was asked about just making the lineup change, and there was just a long pause and just pensive before he decided to say what he was going to say. And, you know, when you hear a coach say something like the guy is supposed to know what he's doing and he's supposed to listen to his coaches and basically says he's not, you know, Tom Izzo to me seemed like a guy who was really searching in the depth of his coaching toolbox to figure out how to light a fire under A.J. Hogard right now. And that's not a good place to be for a guy that is a Hall of Fame coach and a senior point guard.
Yeah, here's my read on it, too, is like I think he sort of hitched his wagon to the wrong point guard in a lot of ways. Not on Curtis's roster, but this is his senior, this is his guy. And they're at their best when A.J. Hogarth is at his best. The problem is they can't trust him to be at his best. And I don't think they can get where they want to go without A.J. Hogarth, but I also don't think A.J. Hogarth can take them where they want to go right now based on what we've seen. I think that is the hardest thing for Izzo to deal with right now, is he sees the best of Hogarth.
He's trying to be loyal to him.
Yeah, and he's trying to be loyal to him in part because he's still his best point guard when he's playing well, by quite a ways, I think. Now, if A.J. Hogarth was not on the roster at all, see, this is where I think it gets interesting, because if A.J. Hogarth was not on the roster and you had to speed up the development of Fears and you played Holloman more and then Walker was playing more at the one, it's a different makeup, and I don't know that it would be worse right now because you'd have consistency, you'd have other guys in defined roles. But the ceiling of Hogarth, the best of Hogarth for like a six-minute stretch against Arizona, for points in time against Georgia Southern, you see it, and you're like, nobody else on Michigan State's team has the size and ball to like take over a game physically, getting into the paint and doing things. And that, the problem is then at like the end of the Arizona game, though, after he does that for a while, the ball still winds up in his hand taking shots from outside of 15 feet in key moments, and he's not the guy to take those shots. Those aren't the shots that are going to win you games. So they've got to work on that in the offense, too. They've got to figure out the way that if he's got the ball in his hands at the very end, they've got to find a way for him to get it to other people. I think they're going to have to look at other lineups. They're going to have to look at small ball situations and late game situations. They don't have enough shooting on this team. It's very clear at this point when you just look at their numbers through, they've in one game this year shot better than 35% from three and looked like a dangerous outside shooting team, and that was Alcorn State. Missing Joey Hauser did in terms of spreading the floor is not something that they can, they don't have an easy answer to overcome that, because he was a true shooter, and that's Malik Hall can make threes, other guys can make threes. Unless we fast forward a year for Xavier Booker, I don't think you have that player anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, and it might be a year and a half, 2 years with Booker. I mean, because he's got a lot of work to do. That's a whole other thing. I think he's got to work on his motor. He's got to work on his strength.
Well, let's go there. Yeah.
But before we go there, I mean, you know, looking at that, at what you said, I mean, between Hogarth, it's not just him settling for the outside shots. When he does get into the paint, when he is going north and south, he's gotten his shot blocked a lot. I mean, he's gone straight up into guys' arms. And that wasn't the A.J. Hogarth that at the end of last year we saw. He was going to and through guys. Now he's going to them and just getting pushed and shoved back to earth with the ball. And that's a difference. I mean, as much as he's sitting and relying on those outside shots, I don't feel like he's driving as strong or trying to finish as hard around the bucket. You saw it in that stretch in the Arizona game, but that's it. That's the only time we've seen it all year, really.
Yeah, no, it's a tough situation. Damned if you do, damned if you don't. And Fears, you know, I think has a higher ceiling than Holloman, and when we see in that Georgia Southern game, him start to attack a little more. I liked Fears actually playing with Hogarth, and you see him, you know, getting to the lane, hitting those floaters. Obviously, he had the 10 rebounds. And
Holloman played well again. I mean, I think Holloman is maybe the best role player on this team, because we saw the one game when he started for Walker, they needed someone to go outside and shoot and score, and that's what he did. And in this game, they needed someone to run the point, get the offense flowing, and he wasn't crashing the boards. He wasn't really trying to do too much on the outside. He was distributing the ball. He had 10 assists.
No, you're right. But on this team, like what they're counting on from A.J. Hogarth is not having that solid point guard, but being also a dangerous difference maker. And that, you know, and I think Fears has a greater chance of getting to that point, but than Holloman does.
The Hogarth at his best is the multi-threat.
Yeah.
You know, he's lost right now on the defensive end too. So it's
which
like,
is weird because when he's locked in, he's still really good defensively, and yet he takes some plays off. His mind wanders. It seems I don't know, and he says all the right things. It's like, are you listening to yourself? You know, I mean, to his credit, out in Palm Desert, he was, you know, Walker didn't really want a whole lot to, you know, do with the post game interviews. He eventually did them, but Hogard sat there and talked and said all the right things, and yet it's just not translating. And there are deficiencies in his game in terms of his shooting ability and other things, but you know, part of it is also the makeup of the rest of the roster. So now let's transition to the big who can shoot who's not ready to play, Xavier Booker, because this is the one thing you see a lot of people talking about online and a lot of fans, I think, are frustrated with. And because, you know, here's a guy who was a five-star, one of the top guys in the class he was in. It wasn't a great class, but still, I think we all thought he was more ready than this. It sounds like they knew it was going to take a while with him. But one thing that Izzo has brought up more and more, because for a while Izzo would talk about strength being the problem. But recently he started saying, there are guys who aren't that strong who can still do it. It's motor. And I think it's motor in the nuances of knowing where you need to be. But it just, you know, in the last game you would see him, you know, miss a shot and then on the other end give up a layup. Like if
it wasn't a layup, that was a dunk, a straight blow by dunk.
Well, it was one dunk, one layup, two plays on the. So he's got to not do that on the other end. Like he's got to be now. I don't know if, you know, in the long term he's better at the five. When he gets stronger, he basically just needs to have a better understanding of things, have a better motor, and be stronger. And that's really hard to do on the fly. Unfortunately for MSU, in terms of skill, he has something that they could use. What will be interesting to see is when Jackson Kohler gets back, and he's not a true shooter the way that Joey Hauser was either, but he's a skilled offensive player. And what does that element potentially offer Michigan State? Especially at end of games. I was just talking about the idea of Hall at the five, going small, whatever you're doing. Is Kohler the best option when you need one more offensive option on a team that's a little more limited because you don't have the Hauser player?
Yeah, and let's not discount what Joey Hauser did inside the arc too, because there were points where he was able to go to the basket and he was a really strong rebounder.
But I think Hall gives you what the interior side of
maybe not to the same level. I don't think to the same quite level. Maybe by the middle of the year, he could be. Because, I mean, you're talking about a kid who last year played hurt, then had off-season surgery. I don't care what anybody says. That takes time. That takes time to get back to and we've seen it in flashes. I think he's been consistent, but just like Izzo said, there's more that for Malik Hall to give, and it's just about the body catching up to it. Booker, listen, I talked to some folks down in Indiana before he came here last year, after he signed, and from what I gathered, there was a coaching staff down in that state that was ecstatic that Booker didn't pick them because they felt they had to recruit him, but he didn't have a motor. And this is a kid that was up until that summer where he was hitting his stride on the summer level, which there's no defense played in the summer level. You know, but he was hitting from outside and he's got 6'11", long wingspan. I mean, that's tantalizing. I mean, he is a better probably NBA prospect than he would be a player as a college freshman. He wasn't Jaren Jackson by any stretch of the imagination. He didn't have the strength of the strong inside game to go inside or out. I mean, he right now is just hovering around the arc when he's in there on offense. He is not a viable post threat. And part of that is because he weighs 210 pounds or whatever it is. So, you know, that's going to take time to develop the strength piece. And, you know, until you get that, you know, you can't be a one-trick pony as a 6'11 guy.
It is interesting. I mean, so you're basically saying he's their foster lawyer, is what you're saying, for that Indiana school. The not in the motor, but I'm just saying that felt like they had to recruit
that other Indiana school might have a lawyer.
Yeah, gotcha. Well, also, he's not tall enough to be a big for that other Indiana school. You have to be at least 7'3" and weigh 200 and weigh 100 pounds more than he does. But the it'd be interesting to see him develop, though. If he sticks with it at MSU and he is willing to be coached, he has tremendous upside. And he is clearly not a one and done in that sense. The thing I thought early on and still think to some degree is, can he be a guy that, you know, you think back to Deontay Davis, who actually played a lot early in that 2015-16 team season as a freshman, but late in the year became a very, very integral cog. Like, he affected winning for them because he did things that, and I'm starting to really doubt whether that's even possible for Booker this year. Ideally, what they would get him to a point is that he could actually play a meaningful role. But it's really hard to imagine, especially as Kohler comes back, that you'll see a lot more, you know, needed minutes for him. But maybe, you know, Izzo said the other day at practice, you know, that he called or whatever and wanted to come in and watch film. And maybe as the light continues to come on for him, it will, because he is a guy, because of his gifts, if the light sort of comes on, and for big guys it's often different, that it could happen rather quickly in certain ways. And again, he's not going to be stronger this year. The guys do not get stronger in season. Weightlifting is an out-of-season thing in basketball. But he could be a guy that all of a sudden he just plays with a little more urgency, and all of a sudden, because of all his skill, he's helpful to be on the floor at times.
Yeah, and I don't want it to seem like I'm piling on the kid either, because from what I gather, like, he's a kid that cares and wants to.
Yeah, yeah.
It's when you're 6'11" and you are kind of a late bloomer in that respect, you're not going to, I mean, the expectations for Xavier Booker because of that fifth star are probably a lot more than where they realistically should be. And that fifth star comes because, why? Because you committed to a certain program, partly, because you've got a skill set that the NBA likes, probably more so, but that doesn't say where you're at the moment. You know, and, you know, those are things that and Tom Izzo is probably the right fit for a guy like that in a lot of ways, because the kid does want it and wants to do it. And it's going to take time, though.
One thing that's interesting is Izzo keeps bringing up that Xavier's parents are on board. That seems to be something everybody understands what needs to be done, and the parents understand that he's not ready. And, you know, talking to Booker back when he was in high school, talking to Booker now, like, he is a bright kid. You're right. Yeah. He is a kid who wants to get things right. He wants to, and the relationship he has with Fears, I think, is significant. Fears has his back. You talk about a guy who is going to be a terrific leader. And I think this is part of the problem Izzo has with Hogard right now, is that his freshman, he sees all the natural things that Hogard maybe doesn't have, and yet Hogard is ahead in certain ways because he's a senior and he's a little bigger and whatever. They're different players, and yet when you see the relationship with Booker and him watching Fears raise Booker's arm on an inbound play defensively and talk to him about where to be. And you know, a guy, I mean, Malik Hall does a lot of that too with Booker, with the other bigs, does it with Sissoko. Where we sit on the baseline, one of the great things about covering Michigan State is where we get to sit for games. And if one of the things, when you talk about the impact of Malik Hall, to watch him talk to Carson Cooper and mostly Mati Sissoko when he's in the game, I'm not sure Mati Sissoko can sometimes play without Malik Hall in there. You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of natural instinct that I don't think Sissoko has that Hall really, really talks and walks him through. And you see the value of that guy.
People have unnecessarily dogged on, fans, I should say, have unnecessarily dogged on Malik Hall, I think, because they saw the broken part, you know, with the foot or the toe problem or whatever it was with him. And, you know, that does take time to get back to where you were.
But he's also never been the guy that I think people hoped he would be. And that is part of that's injuries, and part of that is, you know, we saw early in his career a jack of all trades, master of none sort of thing. And he's never really mastered something that he can hang his hat on. And that just may be the player he is, but that's okay. It's just not. But I think early on he was tantalizing in a lot of different ways,
yeah.
And there was nothing that really developed in those ways.
But if you can contribute as a leader like that, that is absolutely something. Then that might be his best gift. And maybe it's not, you know, maybe it's not a consistent 12-8 or 12-10. Maybe it's just making sure the other guys around you are going after their 12-10.
Well, the next game we cover will be a Big Ten game. So that'll be interesting. Wisconsin on Tuesday. These Badgers are the quintessential Badgers. I will tell you that. Like, they will look like Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. They will talk like Wisconsin. They will walk like Wisconsin. They're not a bad team. And I think a good test for where Michigan State is, because they're not Arizona, but they're also not Georgia Southern. And I think they're better than Butler. Although Butler's had a pretty good run here. I think a Butler win is going to hold up better than you think. But that'll be interesting to see. I after that, we'll come back and do another one of these podcasts. We'll see who starts at point guard. We'll see what they look like. The game counts in the Big Ten standings. They need to get wins against teams that are going to be in the NCAA tournament hunt, and Wisconsin will be, I think. And so it's a big game in that sense. And then they go to Nebraska on the weekend.
Yeah, it's that time of year, and obviously, we'll be keeping an eye. Monday, the portal opens for undergraduates, and it's open season after that. It's kind of like in Western Pennsylvania growing up, the first day after the Monday after Thanksgiving was always hunting season opening. So that's kind of how this is. The first day after the regular season, the first Monday after the regular season, and they're after the championship games, and it's hunting season for coaches to go find portal guys. And then, you know, obviously Jonathan Smith will be busy with that. He'll be busy with getting high school recruits. So we're going to start to see some of those kids and maybe some of those coaches showing up in Breslin Center for some of these big basketball games with recruits. So a lot of things to kind of keep an eye on this month.
If Kirk Ferentz pulled off the greatest upset of all time in the Big Ten championship game, would Jonathan Smith be confused by the Kirk Ferentz statue being built outside his office by fans, at least as a snowman in December temporarily? I think there would be.
I mean, would it be more apt to build a Phil Parker statue there?
I see where you went with that. We'll see what happens with the coaching staff.
Perhaps. And would it be weird if they built a Phil Parker statue and then he hired him as his defensive coordinator?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Just throwing things out there, spitballing.
Things for next week's rundown. we appreciate you listening. As always, please rate, subscribe, throw fruit, whatever it is. Send eggnog. I will drink it. This has been a production of the Lansing State Journal, Detroit Free Press, and USA Today Network. And we will talk to you next week. Thanks for listening.